The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
To begin by saying something maybe a little bit challenging, a little bit surprising to get your attention for the talk. Meditation, to sit and meditate, close your eyes and meditate. Meditation is mindfulness with training wheels. And why I say it that way is that meditation is meant to be somewhat optimal circumstances which to practice mindfulness, cultivate mindfulness, have the side come with mindfulness. But if we leave it only for an issue in meditation, it's really a truncated form of Buddhism or Buddhist practice. We really don't avail ourselves of the full potential of what the practice is about. And we take off the training wheels when we bring our practice into our daily life, into our regular life. And for the practice really becomes meaningful. Does it really change and support your life? Does it help you live a better life? Does it help become a better place? Do other people benefit from you being mindful and practicing? I began to understand this distinction between practice on the cushion and practice in the rest of my life. When I was the first couple of years where I was beginning to meditate on a daily basis, it was valuable. It was valuable for me. I enjoyed doing it. I appreciated what happened to me, the calm, the sense of integrity, the sense of being connected that came with meditation for me. And at some point, I understood that the line between my mind in meditation and my mind outside of meditation was an arbitrary line. There wasn't, you know, I didn't even need to have that line. It's the same mind in both places. And so then, when I saw that, then what got really interesting for me was how to practice in daily life, how to have some of the benefits of a settled mind or open mind or mind of integrity was the language then. How could I have that in my daily life as well? Why should I just leave it to be just something in meditation? And so then one of the primary motivations for doing Buddhist practice and got me deeply involved in, you know, monastic life and Buddhism and all that was not so much to do meditation, but rather to discover how I can take the mind or the heart of meditation and have it in my daily life as well. That doesn't mean going around like a zombie, you know, like calm. And one of the things that was probably useful for me in my early years of practice, I was practicing Zen, and it wasn't so much about being mindful as a technique, like a be-all and end-all, just be mindful all the time. But rather, what I came to appreciate was what I was mindful of, what I became aware of as I paid attention to myself. And I got to see many of the things that I contended with in meditation, many things that I had to kind of work through or let go of or understand or relax around, were operating just as well in my daily life as well. And so the very practice I was doing on the cushion became the practice that I was doing off the cushion as well. It's kind of like the whole world became my meditation cushion. And so one of the first things that I saw early on was that when I sat and meditated, I was able to let go of a lot of my need to present myself to other people a certain way. Certain kind of identity issues. And when I came out of meditations, those would come back. And so then I had to explore that, you know, what's going on with me? And do I want to live my life always, you know, always a performance, presenting myself to people in a particular way so they would see me a certain way? What does it take for me to kind of let go of that so I can have the mind of meditation, in that sense, in daily life as well? What do I have to let go of? What do I have to face? And one of the things I had to face was fear, because part of the reason why I wanted to present myself in a certain light to people was because I felt insecure socially. And so I wanted to find a way to kind of feel safe and to make sure that I was, you know, orchestrate the world so that everyone would see me just the way they're supposed to. They're supposed to. And if you're successful, if you're remotely successful at that, it's probably exhausting. And then I remember stories of this exploration for me was I was living at the Green Gulch Zen Farm, and it was a kind of farm, and we were doing a lot of manual work there. And I remember to heavy things around the farm with someone else, two people carrying these big heavy things. And it seemed like a lot of that. I wasn't particularly strong. I'm not particularly strong. But I think some of the other people were a lot stronger than me, so they could hold up their end just fine, the long thing we were carrying. But for me, I could, you know, an optional practice that I took on was to continue carrying these things in spite of all the pain that I felt. And then how do I work with the pain? What is the pain? What happens to my mind when I'm in pain? To study the contraction that goes on, and that goes pity that goes on. What do I have to be present for? What do I have to work through? What's going on in this laboratory of physical pain, carrying this really heavy thing across the farm? It was optional. I could have said, "Stop, let's rest." But I thought it became interesting. I studied the situation where I had choice. I learned a lot about myself that way, just as I learned a lot about myself in Zen meditation. I think most people, when they do Zen meditation, meditate with a lot of pain. Isn't that right, those of you who've been around Zen centers? So it's kind of the deep. It's a great training. And it's because there are Zen students who have damaged their knees and things like that from sitting and not moving. But it's a great training because you get to look at your mind and how your mind operates under challenges. And do you close down? Do you get angry? Do you get afraid? Do you, you know, disappear into fantasy? What do you do when there's physical pain, that kind of challenge? And what happens to your breathing? What happens to the muscles in your belly? What happens to, you know, all, in your mind, and all kinds of things, what goes on? And what does it take to keep your mind and heart at ease? Keep your belly at ease? Keep breathing in an easy way? What does it take? What does it find? How do you find your place there? People can be foolish with pain, like pain, looking at damaged. But it also can be done very wisely, and it's a great laboratory for this practice. Because sooner, and for most people it's sooner, you'll find your situation that's challenging. Maybe not physically challenging with pain, but some other kind of challenge. And if you have studied yourself in meditation, for example, and really understand and hung in there with a challenge, and not give up, and like the physical pain, don't just get up and go out and go to Starbucks. You know, enough of this. I had a friend who sat sashin, and we sat together, and I thought we were just sitting happily the sashin together, the 7-day Zen retreat. And at the end of the retreat, he said, "Oh, a couple afternoons I went out to the movies." And then I was teaching, just to make sure we could equal opportunity for the different Buddhist traditions. I was teaching a retreat at Spirit Rock many years ago. And this man came in to interview, to meet with me halfway through the retreat, which is the custom. You meet with the teacher 15 minutes and talk about the practice. And he came in quite happy. At first I thought I was not happy for him. It's going well. And he sat down. He said, "I just came back from down the street where I played around a golf." There is mindfulness in golf, but there is a time and place. You know, someday with the training wheels, because that's where the challenge is. You don't want to let go of the challenge. So this working with the physical challenges of daily life, working on the farm, became part of my practice. One of the great Zen training I got was there was a lot of work to be done, and I did a lot of work in kitchens, for example, and. And I'm not, in my early life years, keeping things clean was not one of my particular interests in life. I worked at Green's restaurant for a couple of months, and I worked there for a year once, and then I left, came back and worked for a little while, left and then came back. One time I came back from doing my long year of it, very intensive meditation practice in Burma and Thailand, and I came back the third time to work another 3 months at the restaurant in the kitchen. At the end of my stint there, one of the head cooks said, the time when you came back, you're long, you were different. And I said, how is that different? That would be interesting to know. You leave a mess around. So, how it was formed this. But anyway, in spite of that story, earlier in my Zen training, it was really neat to be working and have people show me how to really clean a sink. I mean, I thought I could clean a sink hand and kind of rub it a little bit, and it's clean. But to really show me how to clean a sink so that you're really there with this 100% both hands, you're really you in the sink, and it's not, the sink's not the afterthought, get it over with and go on to something important. It's like just you, me in the sink. And the sink has all these corners and ledges and really clean the whole thing. And this idea of really giving yourself over to the sink and doing the whole thing was one of the ways of learning how to practice off the cushion. Because in the cushion, you want to have that thoroughness as well, fully present for what you're doing. And what I found, how was a great training for me, not just because I could do it sometimes, but I got to see all the ways I didn't want to do it. All the resistance, all the agendas, all the things that were more important. All kinds of things, impatience. So to really look at this, to include it and really be honest and work with it and not give into it, how to be present in a good way. So this work of taking practice into your life can be very supported by meditation, by having a reference point in meditation of what is possible. So to have a degree of calmness, to say degree of peace, a degree of integrity, a degree of presence, degree of clarity of mind, degree of from anxiety, whatever meditation does for you, if it provides you with some higher quality way of being than you normally have in your life, then that higher quality of being becomes a reference point of what's possible. And so when you go back into your life, you can use that reference point for a number of ways. Okay, is you can pay careful attention as you leave your meditation to notice when you lose it. So imagine yourself coming after a little meditation. And then take the 10 minutes after you get up for daily meditation, the most important time of your practice. And watch at the first signs that you lose that calm or that steadiness or whatever it is you want to, your references. And then as soon as you start losing it, stop and take a look and see what just happened. What did you believe was so important that it was worthwhile sacrificing your calm or your presence or peace? Study that. Get to know. So for me, for example, one of the things I had to learn once I had kids, one of the things I had to learn. When I had kids, that I would meditate in the morning, and the things that had to happen was I had to, after my meditation, I had to get the kids ready for school, make them dressed, get out the house, and. But I like to read my newspaper. When I have my breakfast, I'd like to say, read my newspaper, and didn't want anybody to talk to me, I'm reading the newspaper, and I wouldn't have my time to linger. It was kind of like a little downtime, reading the newspaper, when they had them. And And so what I noticed, I was a little bit slow to learn this, was that I would then have less time to get the kids dressed, fed, and out the door, and to school. By the time I dropped them from school, I was exhausted. I was ready to go back to bed. I don't know, if you've never been a parent, maybe you can't imagine. You know, at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, you're ready to go back to bed. You know, with these kids. And so what I learned was that what I was sacrificing my calm for was that whatever comfort I was getting from reading the newspaper. And is this really worth it? So I questioned it. And after a while, I said, no, it's not worth it. Why do I lose this that I have, this good thing? So then I gave up the newspaper. Morning with the kids all went fine. It went much, much better. So what I'm trying to say is that meditation can give you a reference that then you can study your life better with. One way is by how you lose that reference point, you lose the state of being. And there's a lot of different ones. There can be states of love and compassion. There can be states of clarity, of feeling of inner freedom that can come. And so you watch that and watch how you lose it. But also that reference point also, as you go through your life, if you do lose it, don't have it, it's still there as a visceral. And so it kind of highlights what you're doing. Also, meditation provides a reference. Meditation, many times, is not so nice. It doesn't give you calm and peace and all these great things. It just puts your hindrances right up in your face. You know, you get to see, you know, how crazy your mind, well, not your mind, I would say, how crazy my mind I got to see. Your minds are probably fine. But mine, is it Joseph Goldstein who said, the mind has no shame. And I think he was talking about his own mind. I think because all the things that the mind's capable of doing and thinking. But you get to see the forces of desire, the forces of aversion and anger, the forces of distraction, impatience. You get to see the forces of selfing, self-identity come into play and go on. And as you see that in meditation, you can feel the suffering of it. You can feel the unsatisfactoriness of having those things. So it can be a meditation, let go of them, or to see them as being not so interesting in a way that we often live life. If we're off coffee and I drive the show, like the stage directors that are off stage, you don't see it, but it's really driving the show. And so in meditation, you see it. So that reference point of really getting to know, how quickly you are, is really because as you leave meditation and start your life, you've learned about how quirky you are. Better, is that a better term than crazy? Quirky's better. For those of you who are not quirky, it's okay. But you know how our mind works, the mechanisms of machinations of our mind. We start to see it and understand it much better. And so when we go by our daily life, we understand, and so we can do something about it. We can have a different relationship to it. So this, like bringing the meditation cushion to the cushion of the world, is what really makes it valuable. Without that, I think it's really not that interesting. Without that, it's maybe just a hobby. But with bringing it into your life, then it becomes something that's important. So I wanted to read a few stories from my book of teaching stories I have called The Monastery Within. A scholar came to the abbess and explained, "I have spent a lifetime studying Buddhism, and it has not helped me much. What am I missing? What is it I need to understand? What do I need to study?" To prepare the scholar for her answer, the abbess sat silent for a while. Then she said, "Breathe in an easy and relaxed way, and then study what causes you to lose that ease. Everything you really need to know about Buddhism will be found in that investigation." Isn't that quite something? So when you sit and meditate, it's a place, a time and place to hopefully begin discovering how to breathe with ease, how to breathe in a relaxed way, free way, let the breathing just breathe itself. And that becomes a reference point of what's possible. So when you leave meditation, you can start understanding both what you do that loses that easeful breathing and how to reclaim it, how to get back in touch with it. And in order to come back to that easeful breathing, you have to sometimes work through a tremendous amount of issues what you think, how you operate, your motivations, the things that you do that gets you to tighten up and get tight. So I found that I feel like I try to meditate all day long. It's like wherever I go. But the times when it's most interesting is when I find situations that are challenging. Challenging conversations, challenging activities. And it's very easy to, because the situation is so compelling, to lose touch with myself, not pay attention to what's going on here. But I feel it's so important to stay in touch, because if I stay in touch with what's going on here, and meditate, so pay attention, what's going on with my breathing? Is my breathing tightening up, or is it relaxed and loose and fluid? And if I could stay present and mindful, watching my mind, watching my breathing, watching my body, then the challenging situation becomes just another form of meditating. And it makes me in a better position to respond wisely, to listen more carefully, to be present in a nice way. But if I get pulled into the difficult challenge in such a way that my breathing gets tight and shallow, my stomach gets tight, my mind is spinning and racing about what to do, and I'm leaning forward into the situation or pulling back in some way, then I actually don't come from the best places within me. I don't deal with the challenges as well. So this idea of staying present and breathing, knowing what it's like in meditation practice to stay and just breathe, and breathe into the challenges, breathe into places of tightness, breathe with the unpleasant sensation in the body, to learn how to stay balanced in meditation, to stay in a balanced, resilient posture, and really get a feel of what it's like to be present in this kind of posture that doesn't collapse, doesn't pull back, doesn't tighten up, so that you have that as a reference point, so when you're in challenging situations in life, you can meditate in those situations, meaning you can stay balanced, you can come back, you can stay with your breathing, keep breathing in a fluid way. A young woman from another country moved with her family to live for 1 year in a town near the monastery. When in the course of the year she discovered the monastery, she would periodically visit to have discussions with the abbess. The abbess introduced her to meditation, which became very meaningful for the young woman. When the family's year-long stay was drawing to an end, the young woman asked the abbess, "In my country, there is no Buddhism, and no one has even heard about meditation. How can I continue to learn and deepen the practice you have started me on?" The abbess said, "When you return home, ask far and wide for who among the wise people is recognized as having the greatest ability to listen. Ask that person to instruct you in the art of listening. When you learn what you learn about listening from such a person will teach you how to further your meditation practice." So I read the story now because the opposite is true as well. If you learn to meditate, then you can listen better. You'll learn how to listen. You'll learn how to practice in the listening. It works both directions. So how are you in conversations? Is that a time of practice as well, or do you lose yourself in the conversation? Many people arrived at the monastery hoping to be admitted to the monastic order. Some were sent away since what they were searching for was not to be found in the monastery. Once there was a 30-year-old man who arrived at the monastery feeling exhausted. leave that be a teaser for... I'm sorry. You'll forgive me and I'll start another one. Yeah? Okay. Okay. It's also a young man. A young man once came to the monastery to ordain as a monk. He had been raised in relatively fortunate circumstances with easy access to education. Capable, smart, and friendly, he succeeded in most everything he set his mind to. Deeply reflective about life, he had studied the teachings of the major religions. In his early 20s, he decided not to follow the customary paths of marriage and career. Leaving behind the life he had known, he ordained at the age of 22 and applied himself to the meditation and training the monastery provided. Disciplined, intent, and intelligent, he made quick progress in the spiritual practice. Monks and nuns who had been there for years were in awe of how quickly he settled into deep meditation. Within 3 months of entering the monastery, he experienced his first taste of enlightenment. Immediately, the abbess grabbed the young monk, dragged him out the front gate, and without explanation, kicked him out of the monastery. Later, addressing the residents of the monastery, the abbess explained, "The new monk's realization was genuine, and I am quite happy for him. However, in order for him to mature further along the path of liberation, he has to return to the world to experience more of the difficulties and sufferings of life. To understand all the corners of his own heart, he has to grapple with issues of livelihood, family, and community life. Furthermore, I expect that someday he will be a great teacher. But for this to happen, he has to understand all the issues so that he can have greater compassion and insight into the lives of his students. For this particular monk, this isn't going to happen in the monastery." So he got kicked out. So one more. Maybe so. So, you know, one of the themes of all this is that some people who meditate and are on a Buddhist path are focusing more on going deep into the practice, having a deep meditation experience, going in and practicing. And you see that on retreats as well, meditation retreats, where people go and what they're focused on is a growing edge of their practice, deep states of peace or something. But inevitably what happens on retreats and meditation is that people who can go deep or somewhat deep, a little bit, you know, more than shallow, you kind of, at some point, you come out and you're not so concentrated anymore. And that's a normal thing to have that go on. But what happens is that because people are so focused on going deep, when they start kind of surfacing again, it's over, it doesn't count, I don't have to do anything, focus on it anymore. Until I go back on retreat again or go back and meditate again. But actually, it's the time when you are surfacing, coming out of meditation, that's probably one of the most important times for learning, important times for understanding and resolving and working on all kinds of things. And so, in some ways, the going deep, however far you go, is just a kind of the preliminary exercise to where it really counts. And that is as you come out. So if you sit and meditate at home in the morning, the real practice begins when you get up from the cushion. If you use what happened to you on the cushion as a reference point, as a support, as to help you understand yourself more. And then what did you learn there? What did you touch into there that is useful to consider as a reference point, as a support, as a teaching for you as you start up your daily life? So I want to read one more story, and then if you have some questions or comments, you can mix them. Kind of since I'm talking about meditation so much, as if in the usefulness of bringing it to your ordinary life, here's a whole other alternative. As a teenager, she often visited the monastery. he was deeply attracted to the monastic life. The Buddhist path to liberation was what had the most meaning for her. When she became an adult, she planned on joining the monastic order. However, when she turned 21, her older sister and her sister's husband died in an accident, and she became the foster parent of their two young children. In addition, her own parents had become quite old and needed her help. As the only income earner in the family, she had to work long hours every day. She loved to meditate, but with all the work and caregiving she had to do, she had no time for it. Since she was not able to fulfill her aspirations for following the monastic life, she went to the abbess of the monastery and asked how she could follow the path with the life she had to live. The abbess said that if she couldn't meditate, then the best alternative is to be grateful for everything. So if those of you who meditate regularly, think about not limiting what you do to the meditation time, but bring that practice you do on the cushion into your daily life. And that's really where you probably get a lot of benefit. And if you're not a meditator, maybe you could use gratitude in the same way. That gratitude can be the reference point to understand what's going on, to understand yourself and the world around you. And maybe gratitude can be as powerful. So we can take a few, if you have any questions or comments any you would like to make.
Okay. Yeah. I heard a story from Ajahn Pasano that when Ajahn Chah taught a retreat at IMS, he, after a while, looked at all the meditators and said, "I think you're like thieves with really good lawyers. Thieves with really good lawyers. You live like thieves, and then you come here and feel peaceful as you meditate. And it's like being a thief with a really good lawyer." So how to live in a way that's just being a good person. There's a kind of continuity that he was pointing to. That I just thought I'd share that story because it's so similar to what you're saying.
I was thinking about when you were telling the story about being on the farm and lifting the heavy objects and thinking that I was going to have a different answer, and that has to do with my own path, which is that I think that I've had enough pain in my life, and I was taught from a young age that I should really tough out the pain and that I should take the pain. And my path now actually is to, if I was carrying the log, is to learn how to say, you know what, I can't carry this log. I need to do something else on the farm. And it's just a very interesting, different way of looking at it because of how you, where you come from. But it's still a path to learn. And so that's the path I'm learning right now, is learn how to be more empathic to my own pain and to not feel like I have to take the pain. So I don't know, just the thought, but I imagine that's probably true for many of us in the room as well.
Absolutely. I very much appreciate you saying that because it's true. And you know, we have so many different backgrounds, different ways we're coming, so we have to take into account where we're at. And what helps us to become free, what helps us to become more at peace. And so if you see the opportunity that how you can discover peace or self-understanding in a useful way by staying with pain, then it's a good path, perhaps. But if you don't see it as an opportunity, that it just what wears you down, or is a, or there's a different opportunity for where to find peace, then there might be other doors for people. But each person has their own door. You have to find what your door is in different circumstances. And one of the things that I had to learn was, and it was hard to do in the monastic setting, was to learn how to say no, or learn how to take care of myself when the monastery wasn't going to do it. They had a certain discipline you had to follow. And so how do you work around that when it's not appropriate for you to follow the discipline? And how do you say no? How do you find other options? So I agree. So I'm sure there's lots of people here who need help. What's most useful is not to stay with the pain, but learn how to do something else. So one more. It's right back behind you.
You talked about working in a restaurant, and I work in a restaurant right now, so you might know how crazy it can be. I am better when I'm with, an object, working with the sink, like you mentioned. Like, if I'm just doing something without, people around or something. But if... Who makes me angry so much that, I just think that I lose it at the time, and I think that I shouldn't be like this. But then I think that I deserve to be mad because this person has done injustice or whatever. And then I think that I cannot not be mad at the situation. I don't want to be a doormat or anything like that. So I just notice that I'm mad. But then I cannot control anything about that situation. So if you have any advice for that?
Probably not any advice that, you find that useful, because it's hard to understand the full circumstance you're in to suggest to give any advice. But one of the kind of fundamental things, which can seem like a small thing or maybe not really addressing the issue, is to learn how to relax. And in fast-paced work, like in a restaurant work, it's very easy for tension to build, and the pressure of demand and getting the food out and all these things to kind of build. And so the more tension that we build up, the less resilient we are, less wise we can be about how to respond. And if you can learn the skills of relaxing over and over again, that's, in meditation, learning how to relax, let go, settle, relax the shoulders, relax the belly, and develop almost a habit, then perhaps when you go to work, you can maintain a more relaxed state more longer. And the more relaxed you are, the probably more easier your own wisdom will come to the forefront and learn how to handle difficult situations. You're probably less likely to get angry. If you do get angry, you're probably less likely to get swept up in the anger. So that's what I suggest. Okay, so when I ended my talk, I ended the talk with a story of gratitude. I'm grateful to all of you. It's a great thing to have a community of people you can come and meditate with. I would say that without others to practice with and meditate with, I would not have practiced as much as I did. I wouldn't have benefited as much as I did from my own practice. And I think I really depended on the support of others. And to this day, and this morning as well, I actually feel very grateful the chance to come and meditate together with a group of people. And so thank you for coming. Thank you for being interested in doing this. And now there's going to be tea. And if you would like to stay, it would be great. Everyone's welcome. And then we'll have our community meeting. And because we have this tea and community thing, if you don't mind, I think what's a very nice thing to do in this day is if you would turn to someone next to you and welcome them to IMC, even if this is your first time. IMC belongs to everyone, so even if this is your first time, you can welcome the person next to you as well. And just introduce yourself briefly. Thank you.